Hi, this is Jim.
And this is Max.
Check out our podcast, The Step Over, Liberty Ballers Podcast Network, for all of your Sixers needs.
Player analysis, game breakdowns, who would look coolest in a headband, and more.
Subscribe to Liberty Ballers Podcast feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and check out The Step Over, a podcast about Sixers basketball.
Mostly.
It's out of here! Home run, Lenny Dykstra!
Stairs rips one into the night, deep into right, way out of here.
The Phillies win the game on a base hit by Mitch Williams at 4:40 in the morning.
Swing and a miss, struck him out. It's wacky, wonderful. Bunch of throwbacks has won the National League pennant.
Welcome to Continued Success, a podcast the name of which I remembered just now, and there was no hesitation in my voice whatsoever. I am the head guy at the Good Fight for clearly good reason, Justin Clue. And with me, as always, is Liz Rocher as we begin this, the Friday edition of the Phillies podcast. You cinematic universe. Nailed it. Stuck the landing. We are off to the races for another terrific episode of whatever this is.
And it's been an uneventful week. Nothing has happened to me at all.
Well,
nope.
Maybe not to you, Liz. But I gotta say, last night, Liz, for God's sake, they took it down. They took the whole damn thing down. The 30th Street Station, it's a little flappy sign in the middle that has become such an icon of Philadelphia commuters, travelers, college students bouncing from the city to the suburbs for the holidays. They disassembled her last night, and once more, another part of the city I recognize has been erased.
It's
and
so frankly, fucking depressing.
I find that that's just devastating. You know, I first came to Philadelphia as a college student, so I was at first going back and forth a lot from home to school, and obviously the train station, 30th Street, allows that, you know, that's a huge boon for that, because you can get pretty much anywhere in the surrounding counties in like an hour or two. And, you know, going to that station, you walk in, and the first thing you hear is the like, clack, 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 of that sign. And it's, you know, it's just something that becomes part of your travels. And maybe you don't think about it as much, but then you see other train stations and you're like, oh, not everyone has like a cool, like old timey feature like that. And it, you know, for whatever reason, I haven't looked into this at all. Maybe they were like, the sign was giving people, you know, asbestosis or something. And it's like,
haunted.
Oh, okay, well,
it's a haunted sign.
We should get rid of that. Or it was built by a serial killer. We didn't know at the time, but DNA evidence has proven that. So, okay, there might be a good reason, but for on the surface here, all I can say is that it's very sad. And I hate seeing it go, and just reminds me of all the other sidewalks and street corners that have been torn up in this city, blocked off with yellow tape and replaced by, you know, condos and crap. But, you know, that's the way it goes. That's the flow of city life. But that is one iconic piece of Philadelphia lore that I will certainly miss. I don't know. Did you spend a lot of time in 30th Street ever in your comings and goings from Philadelphia?
Oh, yeah. In college, I lived in D.C., and so I would travel back into the city to visit family all the time. I would just go from the, you know, the train station, Union Station in D.C. to 30th Street. And then, you know, sometimes I would take one of the SEPTA trains out to wherever my family lived. So I haven't seen it in a couple of years, but I'm going to miss it. Why take it down? I mean,
I'm sure
built by a serial killer, not a good enough reason. I'm sorry.
It's not.
We're watching movies made by rapists, you know,
we can look at a sign
that may be haunted or built by a serial killer. I don't know who it's hurting. The march of technology, I guess, cannot be ignored. And I wonder what type of sponsorship is on there that's making them decide. Let's take down this iconic sign that everybody loves and replace it with something that is just like what everyone else has everywhere.
Comcast presents the Amtrak Train Arrivals and Departures Board. Make sure you arrive at Comcast this summer with our three-peat Xfinity Wild deal. Now, here's a local Philly athlete to tell you how great it is to pay $80 a month for whatever this service is. And also for to have like a landline phone in your house. We also are still doing those.
They
anyway, here's the one.
Make you do that with every, we have one. People call it. We don't use it. I ignore it.
After all that, there's room for one train piece of information after all of our, you know, corporate messaging. So yeah, it's that was a bummer, but whatever. That's such as life, Liz. You know, elsewhere in the city, down at the Sixers game, Gabe Kapler, Aaron Nola, and Rhys Hoskins came by to ring the bell before our Sixers embarked on. I think they won that game. I think that was that the Spurs game? No, I don't think so. Yeah. Anyway, this week, the three of them, the Phillies sent three of their envoys to the Sixers game to ring the bell, as they did last year on two separate occasions. At one point, Rhys Hoskins and J.P. Crawford got to ring the bell last winter. And then Gabe Kapler went on a separate journey, and he got to ring the bell, and he struck it so hard that we've been using it at the Good Fight as our victory gif throughout the Phillies season in 2018. Every time they won, we got a shot of Gabe Kapler just doing a quick, efficient hammer strike to the bell. And this year, you know, once again, they let each of the two players and Gabe go in and give it a whack. But it kind of made me think of a question I wanted to ask you, Liz, in watching Gabe Kapler once again go to town on this bell with a hammer. What do you think? What's like the strongest thing you think Gabe Kapler could destroy with his bare hands? Like, do you think he could rip a ham in half, like a full ham?
I think he could. I mean, I think he could rip, you know, some fixtures out of a wall. Like, I'm imagining him doing, now this is something that needs to happen. I'm imagining him doing demo on an episode of Property Brothers now.
Okay.
Just going to town with a giant, it's not bare hands, but, you know, I'm imagining pulling, you know, like built-in shelves out of walls, you know, breaking, formica and wood countertops over his knee, that type of thing now.
The threshold is like the most commonly used phrase is a phone book. And I feel like
I'm going to be obsessed with, can he rip a ham in half? I'm imagining this image in my mind of him just trying to get his hands around a giant ham hock and failing, and then just, you know, cramming, you know, making an indentation with his fingers and ripping it apart like that.
It would take a lot of finger and knuckle strength, which I'm sure he does have.
Yes.
The phone book is more just pure brute, just ripping like right down the middle. The spine kind of acts as perforation, I would imagine. But the ham, this is like a boneless ham. You know, he's got to just get his fingers in the top and then just spread, you know, right down the middle. That's tough. And that's a weird material. I think he could do it. I think he could super do it.
It's enterprising.
Yeah.
He could figure it out.
I'm sure he could punch a hole in a wall, but trying to think like a wall, like not a brick wall, but like the wall in like his office, like something like that, like an office building wall, maybe not cheap, like the apartment you rent when you're like just out of college kind of wall, but like, you know, an official stadium wall. I imagine there's actually a lot of cement bricks behind those, actually, now that I think about it. Don't punch the wall, Gabe Kapler, as you're listening to this. Don't look at the wall and say, like, I could do it. I could do it. I believe that you could, you know, do some kind of damage, but that's cement, and I don't want you to hurt yourself.
He's not the Terminator.
That's true. If anything, he'd be very reasonable about it. I bet Gabe Kapler knows the answer to this question, frankly.
I bet he does, actually.
Yeah, I think he knows what he's capable of, and he's like, oh, he's answering it right now as he listens to this. He's like, it's two hams. I did two hams once, one magical summer down by the lake.
Because he is definitely listening to this.
Yeah, why not? Gabe Kapler was the most recent guest on Hittin' Season, so he's certainly feasible, I believe, listening to this, an equally popular and good podcast.
You know, the next time John manages to get him on, we have to have him ask that question. What do you think you could break apart? What could you rip apart, break in half with your bare hands?
What is his ideal feat of strength? You know, I bet he could toss a barrel pretty far. I bet he could throw, like, do a hammer throw pretty far.
I mean, not every question has to be serious, you know, player related stuff. Like, Gabe Kapler seems like a fun dude.
Or yeah, he would get, you know, he wouldn't be like, I'm just throw the mic down. I'm out of here. Screw that.
What?
Breaks his
How dare you, sir?
Breaks his phone in half with his bare hands, thusly answering the question. Damn it.
And that's not easy like it used to be with flip phones. Yeah. This is an iPhone, which takes a little bit more strength.
Right. And if he has like an iPhone, he carries an iPad around. So that's even heftier. Though I guess if he's using his knee, he could do some damage pretty easily on that. Well, now that we got to the bottom of that, let's get to the bottom of our favorite topic. Where's Bryce Harper going? No, I'm kidding.
But
that did sort of come up this week, Liz. And I don't know how familiar you are with this little very brief tidbit that popped up in baseball news this week. It sort of became a talking point that earlier in the offseason why isn't every team in on these two free agents, the best free agents of a generation? And then that kind of zeroed in on people saying this past week, hey, why aren't the Mets in on either of these guys?
I can understand the asking of that question. Mm-hmm. Of course I can, because everyone should ask that of every single team. But the answer, which I think you'll probably get to, my favorite part about it, as I said in our Yahoo Baseball Slack, was my favorite part is how Brody Van Wagenen when he was asked that question, he did not answer it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He did not give an answer. He didn't even say either of their names. He just said a whole bunch of other stuff. And then Fred Wilpon chimed in with, it's about the money. We're already spending too much. And I apparently have a lot of debt to get out of.
Well,
you didn't say that last part. That was me.
They kind of cited the fact that they had Yoenis Cespedes on the roster, which I initially thought like, oh, they're saying like they have their Bryce Harper already. But I guess what he was saying was we're already paying for Cespedes and we don't want to add to that. I mean, I can read you.
You're already paying $30 million for a dude. Why would I do something else like that to make our team better?
This is Brody Van Wagenen's quote in response to, how much did you talk about guys like Harper and Machado at any point this offseason? So
zero is the actual
I'm looking
answer.
At this quote, and it's so long for what could have just been a blank page. So we talked about every player that was...
or the word no.
So we talked about every player that was available in terms of free agents and trade scenarios early in this offseason and often throughout the offseason. When we looked at our roster and we tried to build our plan, we recognized we had multiple needs that needed to be addressed, not just one area that needed to be addressed. So far, nothing, just nothing. Just checking in with you, with our listeners, a third of the way through this quote. I think the execution of our plan sort of shows what our intentions were of trying to fill those multiple positions. We needed to get better in the bullpen. We needed to increase our run production. We wanted to get better behind the plate. We wanted more right-left balance in our lineup, and we wanted to create more depth. We never looked at this offseason as having one player in mind or looking at this offseason to make one significant investment. The goal from the beginning was try to address all of our needs in the most efficient way that we could. So I got to say, that's not quite as nothing answers go, but he did sort of answer. It was sort of like he answered half a question. Like he answered a different question that wasn't asked.
Yeah, he said we need to increase our run production. I mean, Bryce Harper and Manny Machado certainly can't help you with that.
Yeah, and
like the idea that they can't add more, like the idea that their plan is such that it could not or should not include Bryce Harper or Manny Machado is insane. And the idea that they can't add a $30 million a year player to their roster for the next 5 to 7 years is also insane.
Yeah. I mean, the question wasn't how much did you guys talk about only adding Harper and Machado at any point this offseason? It was just asking if they would add them. And it just, his answer made it seem like at no point in his mind was it ever an option that like they could add them as well as do what they planned to do. Like as if adding Harper and Machado is just a move that exists in another dimension of baseball moves. And like, that's why a lot of other, like most other teams have not been a part of their free agency, because they're just like, oh, well, adding those guys just means so much more. At the end of the day, they're just baseball players. They're expensive ones, presumably. and elite level talent ones, but why that means you're not interested in them. Again, that it's just we're having the same debate all offseason long. Like, every team should be in on these guys, including the Mets. And this is such a – it's just a weird way to look at it. Like, if you added Harper or Machado, you couldn't add anyone else. That's something we saw among Phillies circles as well earlier in the offseason. People saying, like, I don't want to get Harper because I'd rather get these four guys. Like, hey, on what planet does the one negate the other? It was confusing. I'm kind of glad I forgot. There was different phases of ignorance as far as this free agency process has gone. And that was one of the earlier ones. That was interesting. I forgot about that.
Looking back upon this offseason is going to be of all of the moods and phases that there have been, you know, starting with, you know, sort of hope and then realizing nothing was happening and then just counting down days until the winter meetings, like for some reason we thought that anything would happen. I didn't think anything was going to happen there. People thought that they were going to leave with a deal, you know, a month into the off season, like 6 weeks. I'm like, no. There's still like another 2 months of this, you know, but then like now it's all just, everything is terrible every day until one of them signs. And we literally didn't hear anything this week. No rumors about anything from anyone.
You know, so AJ Pollock, he went to the Dodgers, correct? That happened, or that's okay.
Yes.
That's official.
That did happen.
So as
I believe
as it was reported, I mean, according to multiple outlets, AJ Pollock, I'm looking at a headline right now. AJ Pollock agrees to deal with Los Angeles Dodgers, according to reports from AZ Central. And who else is left in the like after Harper outfielder market? Who else is left that's really going to potentially improve your team from like a free agent? From like right now, everything's just on paper. So like, yes, you know, somebody could pick up Jeff Francoeur or something, and he has like a hot May or something. But at the end of the day, you know, AJ Pollock was kind of it would be like if somebody went out and signed Moustakas and said like, all right, we're done at third base, while Manny Machado was just like sitting there. But it does kind of like make it even more apparent that that Harper is still available, that there's no more outfielders left for anyone to even make an excuse like, well, we're mulling over our options. Bryce Harper kind of is the option at this point. Am I wrong? I mean, who else is out there as an outfielder?
I think that's it. I haven't looked at the list.
It's not like
lately,
these two were particularly close, talent level. But you know, it's somebody who didn't want to sign Bryce Harper was looking past him, then yeah, you know, that's where the drop off was. But yeah, that just kind of goes to show. Yeah, it's time for one of these deals to get done, or one of these teams. Like, the players can take as long as they want to decide, but if a team is adamant about improving their outfield right now, that team has to be in on Bryce Harper. And if they don't consider themselves as a team that can sign Bryce Harper, then they're just not going to get to improve their outfield.
I do have a list of available position players for right and left field. Do they have central?
Ah, yes.
Yeah,
that's so right. Adam Jones.
Adam Jones is still out there. Yes, Adam Jones. I'm looking at actual names and not guys like Eric Young Jr., who drove some of my Mets friends insane with his suckiness. Carlos Gonzalez is still out there.
Okay, that's fine. Mm-hmm.
Carlos Gomez. And let's see, Marwin Gonzalez.
I think we're getting into an area where we can.
Curtis Granderson, Matt Holliday.
Yeah, I think starting with probably the last five guys you named, that's kind of the area of like.
Oh, yeah. I was just trying to find ways to fill the air. But that's really, none of them are anywhere near close to Bryce Harper's caliber and a decent, you know, probably at least three quarters of the dudes I mentioned.
Michael Brantley and AJ Pollock were kind of the 2A and 2B options after Bryce Harper in this free agent class. Philly's got Andrew McCutchen, which I don't know how hot of an item he was, but certainly as a role player, he's appealing for the Phillies. But Michael Brantley went to the Astros, and for a while we were thinking maybe he'd be a good fit on the Phillies because, you know, unlike AJ Pollock, he was able to stay healthy, which is something the Phillies have clearly prioritized. And Pollock has been an injury risk for so long. But yeah, okay. So Adam Jones is still out there. The two Carloses are still out there. Again, the drop-off is severe, but every outfielder that disappears from the market makes it all the more apparent that Bryce Harper's still out there. And the Mets are a team that, I think could and should be in on them. And just to close the loop on this, yeah, you know, they say, oh, well, we didn't want to focus on one player. We didn't want to blah, 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 spend that money. Back in June, you know, Andy Martino at SNY actually wrote an article says Mets have no excuse to pass on Manny Machado. So like to get them in on either one of these guys, he's like, there's just no reason for this team not to to use the like $15 million. They're not going to be paying David Wright anymore, and the $12 million in 2020 as like the beginning of an offer that they could put together for Machado. But you know, he was looking ahead to seeing the departure of Asdrubal Cabrera, which obviously that happened in a way that affected the Phillies, Familia, Jerry Blevins, like all these guys, they were paying money, were going off the books. And he was like, yeah, this makes no sense for this team to not be in the mix for these big time free agents. And they haven't been, the Mets have been surprising in how active they've been and how interesting they've been. But, as far as being connected to either one of these guys, it's just been nothing. And, you know, thank God, frankly, I mean, you know, it's enough that the Nationals kind of came back for a minute there to be a part of the Bryce Harper sweepstakes after presumably being out of them. But if we were battling the Mets, well, you know what, if they were battling the Mets, this would be a much more interesting offseason, I think.
It would be. I mean, there's... The Mets they're always going to be that way. As long as they're owned by the Wilpons, they're always going to bank on they're going to try and trade what they have. They're going to bank on having that one amazing year that's going to, you know, cause people to pay attention and pay their bills for the next five. Because after that, as long as they can continue to look like they're trying to compete, they can eat lunch off that, which is what they have been. They're a big market team. Well, they're sort of like the Phillies. You know, because they're not the biggest team in their city. They're not the biggest baseball team in their city, but they have devoted fans. They can sell out that stadium if they wanted to. They could do whatever they wanted, but they just seem bound and determined to just continue. Like, sure, I guess the Wilpons need more money. Why not? I mean, they already have a lot. Sure, they could use more. Who couldn't, I guess? You know, why not? Why shouldn't the rich get richer? And they're not spending enough money. Like, they're not the Rays or the Marlins, who I doubt are spending enough money to stay out of trouble. You know, they're not spending enough. I know I'm trying to remember what it's called, but they have to spend money on their roster, which it doesn't look like they're doing. The Mets aren't there, but they can afford to spend a lot more. I just, you know, I'm glad in a way that they're not, but it doesn't mean they're not still going to hammer the shit out of the Phillies every time they play them. I would at least like it if they're going to do that, if they're going to beat the Phillies, you know, 7 times out of 11, then they should at least be a team that's worth it. I don't want a team with shitty players on it continuing to beat the Phillies. Why? That's my thing. Get better and beat us.
Because I mean, think about what a devastating, unfulfilling crawl this offseason has been. And think about it now, like that from the beginning, Brody Von Wagenen and Matt Klentak's rivalry that we sort of just created on this podcast was a real thing. And from the beginning of this offseason, they were sort of Brody was lobbing aggressive remarks towards the Phillies. Matt Klentak was sort of absorbing them silently, and then forced to acknowledge them during a mandated press conference,
like a jellyfish.
And it became, you know, it'd be I'm looking for anything to have made this offseason more interesting, and I feel like this could have done it. Could have been like a battle in the headlines, two division rivals trying to steal the star player from a third division rival. I mean, that's easily the most interesting thing, just interesting description of a thing in this offseason. And it could have made things just a lot more, I don't know, dare I say, old school. But, you know, with Matt Klentak refusing to participate in trash talk, well, that would be a little hard.
Well, The National League has bad blood. Like, these teams don't like each other. Like, individual people might like each other, but these teams don't like each other on the field. You know, or, you know, maybe I'm remembering it from the past, but the Mets and Phillies have always been touchy. And the Braves and Phillies have never liked each other. Let's just all take that to another level and have it be actually entertaining. You know, I feel like some sports, and I've said this before, some sports have excelled at making the on the field or in basketball, which is mostly what I'm talking about, the on the court, you know, stuff as interesting as the off the court stuff. You know, like, have it, the sport itself is entertaining, but it's not entertaining enough to just sustain anymore. I feel like baseball, it's going to take them another 10 years to figure it out. Like, right now, Alex Bregman is the only dude out there trying. You know, there are other dudes that are doing, they do Twitch stuff, but like, they need, we need beef. Like, and the fake respect, the respectability bullshit in baseball that, you know, and it's everywhere in journalism, in, you know, sports writing too. That everyone must respect each other, you know, that everyone must just respect each other. Everyone has to, you know, everyone's shaking hands and, you know, saying, you know, this is just a game. You know, we're all fine with each other. Like, can we not, God forbid it be entertaining. You know, like, good example, like this week, I think it was Nick Markakis signed a contract with the Braves. It was a small contract. Granted, he is older, but he should have gotten more. But he gave a quote that was, yeah, I'm fine with it. I just play a kid's game. It's so shitty for him to throw
those homerific Braves beat writers under the bus. They love that. Those guys with Brian McCann posters up in their bedrooms. Yeah, they love that.
I just could. It was so bad. Like, I wanted to punch him in his smug face for such a lack of solidarity. But, you know, that's the, you know, he's expressing his opinion. I think it's a bad opinion, but could some players maybe clap back at that? Could we not have some entertainment in the offseason? Could we not have players talking to each other about things? Maybe it shouldn't be done on social media, but Markakis gave that quote. He said it out loud to a reporter. He said it out loud with the intention of it being broadcast to people. So have that be an open discussion. Or someone, for the love of God, join Alex Bregman out there. He is the broiest bro to ever bro. He's trying to create his own baseball entourage.
Let me ask you this then, because this sort of brings up the contradictions or at least the difficulties that someone trying to gauge the interests of baseball fans would have. Because we say that, you know, sometimes we want players to be aggressive or showy. We want them to be entertaining and get in each other's faces and have these like off the field rivalries sort of blossom. But we do also say, like, we were just faulting the idea of saying, like, oh, it's just a game. It's just a kid's game. But when certain things happen on the field, that's our response to them. Like, when players are too intense or, like, get in fights, sometimes that's, like, how we respond. Is like, oh, my God, you guys, it's just a game. Like, grow up, blah, blah, blah. So, like, doesn't it seem like there's a very thin window at times for baseball to be the kind of sport that we as fans want it to be? Because I agree with you. I want to see more like rivalries. I want to, for a long time, I'm kind of trying to harken back to a day where the American League and National League were rivals, but that does not exist anymore. They're just two separate bodies that happen to house baseball teams. I think all of that for the entertainment factor of baseball would be huge. And that's something that baseball really needs to pump up, but they're operating in this world where fans kind of, I feel like, allow sometimes a very slim window for baseball to slip through. So like, what would be enough? Like, one day two guys are sniping at each other on Twitter. Okay, that's like entertaining. The next day one of them throws a fastball in the other's ribs and we say like, that's too much. And you can't really like police that line in every version of this. So like, what do we want?
Well, I think you say that there's a fine line. Like, I think the line between sniping at each other on Twitter and posturing on the baseball field, mm-hmm. I think there's a big line between that and throwing a baseball at someone's head. And I know you almost in baseball, because of the way it is, because it's not timed like basketball, and because, you know, you can throw a basketball at someone's head and it's not good, but it's also not traveling at nearly 100 miles per hour. And you're not throwing it from such a distance that, you know, it's going to really do, you know, the type of damage. So I see what you're saying. I think it would be great to encourage them not to be violent on the field. I think maybe that's the line. I think the, you know, the line is don't be violent. I think it can be done. You know, I think it absolutely can be done. But, you know, everyone, like, AJ Hinch came down on Alex Bregman when he called out whoever the hell it was on the Red Sox, Nate Eovaldi, because he hit a bunch of home runs. You know, the Astros hit a bunch of home runs off of him during the season. You know, that's exactly it. Like, look at Joel Embiid. The dude does not care. He will call out anybody. He will call out anybody that he faces on the court who he thinks he can get the better of, you know, even when he doesn't. He's confident. And some of it, I'm sure, is done for show. But, like, that is why I find basketball so entertaining, because no one hesitates to start, you know, to start shit with each other. But also sometimes,
conversely, you have Derek Carr calling out Max Kellerman and Stephen A. Smith on First Take on ESPN. And boy, I gotta tell you, there was nothing more cringeworthy than watching like three goobers kind of circle each other from very far away, and a rivalry or sniping, as we're calling it, never getting much further than never getting much closer than social media, and like using each of their own platforms to call each other out. Like, that was so lame and embarrassing. Like, that sucked. And then Derek Carr finishes it by posting a gif, not of himself, but of like some random dude doing a squat by being like, I'm tough, I gotta go work out. Like, oh God. So, I mean, yeah, that it's person to person. Yeah.
Listen, it's not always going to be gold. It's not always going to be great. But, you know, that's the risk that you run when you invite, not even invite this, when you say that this is welcome, because coaches don't concern themselves with that. Like, it's bizarre. AJ Hinch will concern himself with Alex Bregman posting, you know, the equivalent of a diss track on Instagram. But as far as, you know, the alleged domestic abuser, the alleged assaulter of a woman on his team, he's not going to talk about that. That's not going to be something he discusses. Who cares? If the managers are going to jump in to what their players are doing when they're not on the field, you can't
start with the babies. Yeah.
You know, if they're going to act like a babysitter, then you got to take full responsibility. So, exactly. So if you're not going to bother with Roberto Osuna, then stay out of all of it. It's not your responsibility to regulate what your players post.
Well, you're
on
right.
Instagram,
by
AJ
jumping
Hinch,
into that, like, and not jumping into story, domestic violence issues with Roberto
Shut
Osuna,
up,
then
AJ Hinch.
You're saying, you know, that doesn't matter. You know, like, that's why you can't talk about any of it. And if you're going to talk about only one, you know, you'd think it would be the much more important issue, but it wasn't. And that kind of brought that to light. I just think, just back to the original point of this rant I set us on. No, it's okay. I honestly just think about this a lot, because I'm somebody who I'm a fan of baseball and I want to be entertained. I find myself like, yeah, who isn't going to watch a brawl? Who isn't going to, like, when they're like, oh, we're cutting to, there's a reason that, like, when they come back from commercial on like MLB Network or SportsCenter or whatever, that if there's a brawl, they show that footage because people want to see that, because it's fun, it's funny, it's, but like, people's careers have ended because of brawls. People have suffered injuries because of brawls. It just brings the question, like, yeah, I want that, but like, we also say we don't want guys running into catchers at home plate and like decimating them. So that's when I say, where is the line? It's sort of like, we very clearly are in search of one, because there's aspects of the game we want to see, like a violent aspect of the game we want to see, but only up to a certain point. Like, it kind of brings to mind that the Simpsons when Principal Skinner's mom is like, I want everything in one bag, but I don't want the bag to be heavy.
So here's the situation. Imagine Nate Evaldi and Alex Bregman facing each other this year, which they're probably going to at some point. So, you know, if we lived in a world where it was okay for baseball players to kind of have this drama and be dramatic to each other on the field, I think we could, you know, I think we could get there because, you know, Nate Evaldi, it could be very tense. I'm just imagining, you know, the announcers talking about the things that they've posted about each other, their past history, and they're, you know, they're both very intense. And of course, I'm imagining it like a movie where there's dramatic music. That's not actually what would happen. But, you know, if they were allowed to do a little bit of posturing, if, you know, if Evaldi struck him out, if he was, you know, if it wasn't considered the most biggest diss of all disses for him to celebrate a little about, you know, punching out this little pitcher at the plate, then I think we would be closer. But because those little things are not really allowed yet by managers or whoever, we're at the point where when someone decides to show it in a way that someone doesn't like, we get a brawl. You know, there's been some easing off of that. There's been an easing off of celebration. And I think the next place it has to hit is batter pitcher, you know, interactions. Because, you know, a guy will hit a home run and he'll do a little bit of celebrating, but it'll mostly be, you know, when he's coming down to the plate, when he's there with his teammates, you know, it's never really directed at the other person. I'm trying to, I think if there was a, you know, if we could find a way for baseball players to be able to express some of this to each other on the field, because it's a game and it's competitive. Like, yeah, we could say, you know, we could say it's a game in a bad way, but it is a game. So why can't they just posture at each other?
Describing here? I mean, we talk about that brawl, or we just did talk about that brawl between the Reds and Cardinals a few years ago now that started with, off the field, Brandon Phillips saying, I hate the Cardinals. I hate them. He was leading off the next game that they were playing, which was against the Cardinals. And everyone knew something was going to happen. They just something at some point in the game was going to happen. And the anticipation probably led a lot more people, or at least a couple more people to watch that game than would have otherwise. Cause people knew going in, it was like professional wrestlers taunting each other before facing each other. It wasn't like they had to wait. It wasn't like he said it at the end of the third game of a series and like they weren't going to see each other until August. But like there was an entertainment component to that. And that's something I've thought about a lot, just considering like my own fandom, and with fandom being such an issue for baseball and involving younger people in the game, when the game itself mm-hmm. isn't enough to draw people in, you got to give people a little more to go on. And that's what baseball, if it's toning down the bench clearing brawls, if it's toning down, you know, relief pitchers jogging in from the bullpen to do nothing, like these silly little parts of it that we at different times roll our eyes at but also celebrate. It's just kind of, maybe that's why. And I feel like we talked at one point just how baseball needs to define itself a little better. But I think they're probably asking themselves the same questions at this point. Like, what do people want? Like, what are we supposed to do? Which part of this are we supposed to celebrate? Because we get equal amounts of clapback for whatever version of it that we try to present. Yeah.
Look to basketball. That's all I can say. It's not perfect, but look to basketball. And why, I mean, Joel Embiid has very quickly become a folk hero in Philadelphia. It doesn't matter where he goes in his career, he'll always be part of this city. And you can't say that about any of the current crop of Phillies, because as great as they are, what personality have we seen from some of them? Other than, I'm nice. Like, I love Rhys Hoskins, but he's not going to try and show up a pitcher right. other than trying, you know, hitting a massive runoff. Like,
we love seeing Adrian Beltre and Elvis Andrus be friends on the field. We love seeing two friends on, again, Brandon Phillips and Jimmy Rollins had a moment like a couple years ago. Jimmy Rollins slides into second and they were just like mm-hmm. clowning on each other. in front of the umpire, and the umpire was like in on it, and it was like funny. It's like a charming little moment. But you also want them to sort of hate each other. You know, you want guys, you read stories about old baseball games from like way back in the day in the dead ball era, and like guys are just kicking each other in the shins, like just because. And like they would be like, "Why'd you do that?" And they just wouldn't answer. It's like, because we're on different teams and I hate you. So I guess when I say the small window of acceptable, like this kind of entertainment behavior, that's what I'm talking about. That we like both of those things in baseball. And it just seems like it's a difficult thing for them both to live next to each other. But I guess the idea of like, I'm friends with some people and I hate others, isn't that strange of a concept. That's how we all kind of just go through life. So I don't know. I don't have the answer to that, but it's something that I've definitely thought about clearly. So we'll move on past that to, you know, Liz, we've been seeing it more and more images kind of eke out of spring training. We've seen fuzzy images of very far away Odubel Herrera, bunch of young prospects down there. We know enough to know that Odubel's gone back to the exploding firecracker hairstyle, which I love. Awesome. More of that, please. He's down there early, but he's been joined by Andrew McCutchen, I believe, is down there already. And now we're seeing footage of Michael Franco taking some cuts. And he's using a new leg kick that was noted. And, you know, this is one of those adjustments we see during spring training. This is something that's a little different for him. Didn't look super comfortable doing it, but, you know, it's not even spring training yet. You just kind of throw this onto the – well, let me ask you. Is it exciting to know that a player who's like always been considered on the up and up, somebody who's like, oh, he could be a key player if he really like wraps his head around his issues, makes some adjustments. That's the big word, adjustments. Is it exciting for you to see a player who's perpetually in that state come to spring training, trying something new, a dramatic enough adjustment that, you know, maybe this will be the thing that fix him? Or do you just throw it onto the pile of past young players who've made adjustments and really it's turned into nothing?
I'm excited because, you know, it's a guy that we're invested in. With Franco, we're invested in him. We want to see him do well. You know, we know he has that potential, and we're all hoping at this point. I mean, we're years on from his debut now, and we're hoping that he can find that thing that will unlock his talent permanently, or at least for a longer period of time, you know, where it can be unlocked again. So I'm excited about it. I want to see how it goes. You know, I don't know what's going to happen with him, whether they're going to keep him or not. They love having part-time players. The Phillies love part-time players. So, I wouldn't be surprised if they somehow found a way to keep him around. Even if they did
I want him to do well, finally. I'm excited. Nothing was more exciting than what was it, May 2013 with Dom Brown, when he just absolutely caught fire, 2014, maybe. But really, that's all we have of him, that 1 month. Like, we really – that stands to me, like, at this point, remains the threshold for young players who are in that position where it's like, you got to figure
it
out.
It's really
been long enough. It's time to figure it out, or we got to move on. And it was just like, you didn't want to trust it. You know, he hit, like, 3 home runs really quickly, and you're like, this is great. I don't want to trust it yet. Then he, like, just goes off. And for an entire month, you're just like, all right, like I gotta trust it now. Like, it's been a full month. You know, it's still a small sample size, but it's enough of one that you're like, this could be who he is now. And then it just wasn't. and he was an all-star, which I always forget. Yeah. But, you know, he, like many other young Phillies, underwent some adjustments, which is exactly what we're seeing Franco do. And I just wanted to run through a list I composed of past Phillies, young Phillies players who were potential keys to the future and the adjustments they made. Some are exactly what you'd expect. Some are not quite exactly what you'd expect, but just kind of goes to show the just like endless litany of the endless versions of this story that we've heard before. And in Brown's case, you know, people were like, oh, well, he broke a bone in his wrist and then that healed. Yeah. And doctors said like that takes 12 to 18 months to fully heal. And like right before he went on his rampage was like that time was
the hammy. Yeah.
So people were like, oh, his wrist bone is fully healed. Charlie Manuel said that Dom Brown was was catching the ball early in his swing, which was helping to keep it in the air, which is like how he was getting. Yeah. So it was like, okay, all right. That's an adjustment he made, but that happened so quickly. I mean, maybe he's just swing was faster or something like that. That helped him. Ruben Amaro kind of pointed out that, yes, he admitted Brown's benching, for, you know, large chunks of seasons without getting sent back down to AAA. Maybe he said, quote, maybe to the detriment of his development, which yes, I can't say that that's the thing that screwed up Dom Brown, but boy,
oh, really?
Did it really not help.
Uh-huh. It did not
we
help.
We can get one in there.
I'm starting to, you're going to go through your list, and I'm going to wish doable. That we had some kind
of Dom Brown,
you know,
they said that
he
was being more aggressive on pitches in and out of the strike zone. I think that month that he went off in that month of May, he also like didn't walk. So he was just swinging the bat nonstop and was just like, well, I don't know, the ball keeps hitting it, so I'm going to keep doing this. But that was what Dom Brown did. Cody Ashe, meanwhile, his big adjustment was that he married a nutritionist and was just much more in tune with his health. He also worked with Mike Schmidt on hitting more line drives, and we see how well that worked out
that
because
later.
Cody Ashe is still with the Phillies and hitting line drives. This is where I'll put the fail horn. And again, this isn't to like go back and just malign these guys for being, you know, not the players we wanted them to be, but it's just more pointing out the endless cycle of this process that we've seen throughout the years. Because, you know, there was a point when John Mayberry, you know, feel like we're figuring that out. Yeah, this was way back when Shane Victorino was still with the team, Hunter Pence was still with the team, the outfield was still, it was in its post Ben Francisco is the answer phase, and people were looking at John Mayberry, like maybe this guy's the answer. Well, John Mayberry started standing closer to the plate, started one outlet just said he started using his legs. I don't know what that's supposed to mean. He stopped army crawling up to the plate and just flailing at the ball with the bat while face down on the ground. And he started getting, and this is going to be a common pattern, consistent at bats really helped him become a better hitter. But, you know, again, that didn't, whatever success he had certainly didn't hang around. Darren Ruff.
Well, and this was the season, just a mere month after he completed the best season of his career, which was 2011, where he hit like 273 with, you know, 15 home runs. The next year he would hit 245. And that would kind of be the high water mark for the rest of his
through
career.
The filter of hindsight,
you know,
we
like
can look back and laugh at these
that.
Adjustments
He's like,
not
I'm
working.
Make
but like in
a
moment like that, it was just like, yeah, we've seen enough promising moments from John Mayberry to think, yeah, maybe. You know, we tried it with Ben Francisco. There's no reason we shouldn't try it with John Mayberry. But yeah, that's that. You know, consistency. That was something that a lot of these guys were missing because they were coming up from being young guys who were being platooned in or were just fourth outfielders like Mayberry or were bench players trying to work themselves into the lineup. Darren Ruff, when they were trying to, this is more of an adjustment on the defensive side. They were trying to make him into a left fielder. And yeah, this is a common thing back then. For him.
Which they also tried to do with Cody Ashe.
Yeah, and Scott Kingery, they said he might get some reps in the outfield.
And
yeah,
now, because they literally did that with Rhys Hoskins.
Well, what cracked me up about this Darren Ruff article was that...
left field is a position that,
you
know, anyone can play.
The main thing he's adjusted is really just
it.
Awareness. And that's really helped him. And Darren Ruff's like, yeah, I've really started, you know, taking into account the situation. Like, who is batting? Who is on base? You know, how many outs are there? You're like, were you not doing that before?
Well, and was that a normal thing? Because like now every player, like they've got that shit on their arm. They're looking at it. You know, everyone has to know they've got the spray charts memorized and stuff like that. Like that
it doesn't
was
matter.
That not
it's all
common?
It's all like, the same amorphous
the
blur
back, you know,
of
20,
of
whatever
crap.
The hell this was.
There's just nothing.
Again, wow, what a dark time.
blob of shitty play. I completely forgot it. Oh,
on Ryan's Hendricks team? I don't know. Look at the Jumbotron between the bats. I don't know.
As an outfielder or infielder or anything. Like, just like, he's like, so now I'm really, you know, paying attention to the game.
I guess he's transferring from first base, which is not a defensive first position, to the outfield, where, yeah, that's obviously, those things are going to be taken into account. I feel like you're probably shifting a lot more as an outfielder and have to be more aware than you are as a first baseman. And, you know, this is Darren Ruff. I love Darren Ruff's post Major League Baseball career in Korea. They love him. He clearly loves being there. I love it all. I fully support that, and it's wonderful. So, like, I get why he had to. That's like an adjustment for him, but it's just funny to see in words him being like, "Now I know how many outs there are during a given at bat." You're like, "God damn it, Darren, what are you doing out there?" And that's the thing. Like, all these guys wanted to play more, and they just didn't have like the stuff to get them a full-time playing role. But then the argument was always, yeah, but if I was playing the whole, like, all the time, then I'd be able to get into a rhythm and I'd be better. And you just sort of go round and round with that argument, as they did sort of with Tyler Goodell for a moment, who was supposed to be like the next golden child from the Rule 5 pit after, and I got to tell you, so many articles referenced Shane Victorino. Ender Inciarte, Odubel Herrera, as the Phillies being like weirdly good at Rule 5 draft picks. Look, no one's denying that those are three pretty good Rule 5 draft picks. There's a lot, correct me if I'm wrong, but like, there's a lot of luck that goes into the Rule 5 draft. Am I not wrong? Like, obviously they're picking people that they presumably are aware of and have followed and are just like, well, of our options, this is our best guy. But like that, they did blossom into like full-time great players in Ciarte, obviously after he had left Philadelphia. But like at least role players, but also impactful ones. I mean, Victorino and, were all three of them all-stars? Was Ciarte an all-star at some point? Cause I mean, like, go ahead.
Oh, I'm pretty sure. If not, I'm sure he will be. I think he's still doing well. I mean, I was just going to say, like, our former colleague did, Eric Chesterton, a couple of years ago, did something over at Cut 4 about looking at some of the best Rule 5 draft picks of the last decade. We've got R.A. Dickey, Everett Cabrera, who I barely remember, Darren O'Day, you know, Marwin Gonzalez, Tommy Canale, Justin Bohr, Odubel Herrera. Like, in those are some big names, but it's so much luck. Like, the guys that are picked are usually, you know, they're left exposed because either there's no room for them on the roster, or there's no room for them because they're blocked. You know, they're guys who they don't have a role. And so you're just sort of picking the best of, you know, who can't fit on the roster.
Ender Inciarte, he was an all-star in 2017 in the midst of three straight Gold Glove seasons. And, you know, he'll get a fourth straight Gold Glove this year because his last one was in 2018. So, yeah, if you're picking guys from the Rule 5 draft, obviously that takes a level of just like talent evaluation. And if you're so good at talent evaluation that you keep hitting on the Rule 5 draft, why are you missing so much on the amateur draft? I guess that's my point in why there's got to be a segment of luck involved in this. So in any case, Tyler Goodell was sort of played up to be that new guy. But, you know, and in that moment where he like, okay, he hit like a few RBI extra base hits. Then, of course, he got his article saying like, what did Tyler Goodell do to turn it all around? And he was just like, I was able to get my timing down, see more pitches with more frequent starts. And, you know, you get a little bit of that, like, I told you so, like, just play me more and I'll be good. And unfortunately, that didn't work out. I was really rooting for Tyler Goodell. I really wanted that Rule 5 narrative to work out. Unfortunately, it didn't. Real quick, moving through these last three guys. Cameron Rupp, you know, when he hit his point where they profiled him and said, like, all right, is this guy the catcher of the future? Maybe. Here's how. They really stressed his tutelage under A.J. Ellis, who was with the Phillies for all of 11 games. But he said he learned a lot from Carlos Ruiz, but then AJ Ellis came to the team and spent like just an absurd amount of time with his pregame rituals of like watching film and learning about the other teams and the other, like the other hitters and where to put the ball against them and everything. And Cameron Rupp was like, wow, yeah, I learned a lot from just watching him do that. And, you know, unfortunately it didn't work out for Cameron Rupp, but that was his, that was supposed to be his pivot. Freddie Galvis, he went on a diet where he flushed out 10 to 12 pounds and then built it all back out with muscle, because this was when he started showing off this weird amount of power. So people were like, oh, is Freddie Galvis now an offensive, not just a defensive player? And he got his little moment in the sun. They said, oh, he had a more natural swing and he made his adjustment by putting all the weight on his back foot. And, you know, Freddie Galvis, not a known fearsome power hitter in the National League right now. So clearly that didn't work out in the long term. And but finally, Ben Revere. And in his case, it was, you know, outfield assists. And he was not known as particularly good at throwing outfield assists. He actually said he had started throwing what was basically a four seamer. Then the Twins coaches kind of like messed with him a little bit. He wound up throwing more of a cutter, which was terrible. But his big adjustment was getting moved to left field instead of center. And he had started making his throws with an amount of backspin. And they were traveling so much further that people were like, wow, you got really strong this year. And he was like, no, I'm just throwing the ball differently. And he didn't have as far to throw. That was the adjustment he made. And Ben Revere, not a considered particularly dangerous outfielder to run on past that point. So we're just pointing out the absurdity in adjustments in this early in the season. It's great to see Michael Franco making adjustments. Not like that shouldn't happen. And we're very excited to see, hopefully this is like an answer of sorts for him, but you know, it's not the first time we've heard this story and it's fun to go back and see all these names that we've since forgotten and all the adjustments they made to try and stay in the league. Now, before we get out of here, we're going to do a new segment. I think that's going to be a more regular part of our show. But Liz, I want you to tell people this exciting new information.
Yes. I'm starting a segment. I collect baseball cookbooks. Teams put out cookbooks. You can find them on eBay, ones that are old. I own both Phillies cookbooks. I haven't been able to find information about whether or not they put one out at any point in the olden days. You know, teams have, but not all of them do. But over the past 10 years, you know, 8 years, the Phillies have released two cookbooks, one in 2010, one in 2015. Featuring players, awkward pictures with them in fake kitchens, not even kitchens. It's just a table that they've set up with a tablecloth and a bunch of cooking implements and what I'm presuming is mostly fake food on it. But they share their recipes and little stories, and I'm going to find a recipe from these books and possibly other ones.
Welcome to our new segment, Liz Reads Recipes.
I'm going to feature
calmly and passive aggressively.
I'm not going to actually read the full recipes because that's boring. Recipes, yes, that you will have to rush to write down if you even want to consider. If anybody is interested in actually making these recipes or anything like that, please find me on Twitter and we can work together. I can send you privately information about that. So first up, we've got Cody Ashey. He is in the 2015 edition of the book, which contains some stars like Jerome Williams and Chad Billingsley, Aaron Harang looking like a murderer.
Why 2015?
Yes, I will try and
why
post
was that the year they decided
photos
to
that
do
go
this
with
again.
These recipes every week because some of them are doozies. My God. I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, it's Philly's wives. The Philly's wives do it, and I think
there were enough wives.
I don't know. There were enough wives in 2015. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe. So Cody Ashey. That's all I could think of. So because a bunch of them had just gotten married, you know, and so maybe that had something to do with it. But Cody Ashey, we mentioned earlier that he married a dietitian. Her name is Angie, and she features into the recipe for Caribbean jerk chicken. So this is a quote. I follow a pretty strict meal plan that my wife Angie made for me, but I veered off of it quite a bit on our honeymoon. We both fell in love with Caribbean food, which is where I'm assuming they went. And when we came back, I was craving it. She created this healthy version for me, and it became one of my favorites. They are standing there cut a looks like a tomato. She looks like Rashida Jones. It's the only thing I could think of. She's so pretty. And he's such a doofus next to her. Oh my God. She's cutting a tomato you can tell it's like an actual pointy knife. He is holding a butter knife to the surface of this tomato.
I was kind of thinking it would be an entertaining component in one of these books.
And there's a frying pan with just
focus
two
on
whole
like,
chili peppers.
At least on one of the recipes, have it not be one of the married players and just have it be like this sad bachelor meal composed by one of the young single rookies who's like, I don't get paid that much, so I eat cheese sandwiches. Here's a Darren Ruff sad cheese sandwich from 2015. That's a good one. Yeah,
we've got I will Justin DeFreitas his homemade pizza. But yeah, there's Jake Diekman is in this book too. This edition. Goodness, Cesar Hernandez has a wife and a hairline. he has a wife and a child. There is a baby. I'll forever marvel that we don't really know. There's Darren Ruff in this book. He has a wife named Libby. She is also cutting a tomato with the same knife that Angie Ashy was using. Darren Ruff is standing above a pot. Looks like a pot that I own, honestly, with a large wooden spoon and a glass bowl of tomato sauce, which he's poured.
Sure, that's how you do
tell
that.
He's poured it into the bowl, and then he's staring at the he's staring very intensely and very wide eyed at the camera. Yes, the recipe that they chose are Italian turkey burgers, which no, thank you. I'm not a fan of turkey burgers. Here's the quote. This is my go-to recipe whenever my wife Libby and I are in the mood for some Italian flavors. Although you can make it with buns, we don't use them, so the meal works out.
That's not making it into your big Italian Thanksgiving
burger,
list. Your
man.
Italian
it's not a burger.
Bunless
a
Italian
bun.
Turkey burger.
It
burgers.
Is a meat patty. We always no bunless burgers. We also always add some type of vegetable as a side. How innovative! It only takes a minute to. It only takes a few minutes to prep everything, but it cooks quickly. We leave the burgers soaking in the marinara sauce.
Some people strive to be
flavor
normal,
while we
that's,
get the
and that's
kitchen
perfectly fine.
Up. They are normal. Oh God. I'm going to have to, I have to spend just one more minute talking about Cliff Lee, who is in this book alone, no wife, no kids. He's got a frying pan.
Cliff Lee's isolated
mini
carrots.
Carrots in it, which is related to his recipe, which in no way did he create this, but, he's like, the picture is him with the carrots in midair because he's flipping them up from the frying pan. But next to him, there's like a stemless wine glass full of walnuts.
An Arkansas favorite, absolutely.
And then a regular wine glass crammed full with carrot, with mini carrots. And just a bowl of spinach. And there's... There's just a bunch of baseballs, next to some vegetables, and then there's a bunch of baseballs
well
inside
he
of a
is
saucepan.
Just sitting there eating baseballs like
there
apples.
Are no recipes for
just
baseballs.
Reaching in, taking a bite, spitting it out. Maybe that's how he learns about the baseballs. I mean, that's how he got so good at pitching. Was he knew how a baseball tasted? You know, he knew how that leather felt in his teeth.
Sorry.
So this is my last one. I don't want to spoil everything, but since we just talked about single rookie, sad meal, we've got Cameron Rupp and his honey garlic chicken, which has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, like 7 recipes, and one of them is water. So this is definitely a, let's see, his quote is, "I live with the Ashies during spring training, and they'd cook up a lot of chicken recipes, including this one." I feel
that
for him already.
Wow.
Eventually,
a
I had to
that
learn how to make
good.
It myself, like, because I love chicken.
Honestly,
but the
I
only
would,
way I really knew how to make it was by
somebody
frying
from Texas
it.
Cooked. Like that,
sounds
that's
fine to me.
The
now, the honey garlic chicken is my favorite
in
healthy
Texas
meal.
Are right up my alley.
Yes.
Okay.
And then the photo, he's
I think
got,
that's called a Texas
the
salad.
Same sharp knife. He's got a tomato speared on the end of it, and he's holding it up. And then he's got a pair of tongs in the other hand with a single carrot. It's really, it's beautiful and stunning. These, I mean, I think you could still find these. I think that they might still be available to purchase. If not, find you could probably find them on eBay. They are a delight. They are. I find team cookbooks from any era, they're largely done by the team wives. They are always just awkward as hell. And I love them so much for this, because you often don't see in baseball anything that is not totally and completely slick. And they try real, real hard. But like when you leave teams to their own devices, they're going to put up like a number fire. Jesus, they're going to put up like an angel fire page for whatever it
and
is.
And honestly,
they
maybe
need
maybe
with,
we'll even like
know,
cook a few of these and review
image.
Them in future episodes.
So I kind of enjoy things that are a little bit more low rent and a little more natural. Absolutely. I think that is an excellent idea. We can do that. Maybe we'll put some of those on the main feed. We can put some of them on Patreon as well. Please, if you enjoy this content and want
yeah,
more
we got
of it,
plenty of very interesting and cool Patreon. Bonus content going up there. So
$5
if you like all
you
the stuff you get from
hit and
season,
that we
continued
have,
success and the dirty inning, there's
you. So it's Patreon
on a monthly basis going to be plenty of stuff showing up on our Patreon that is well worth the very, very low price of $5. You can toss us and we'll continue bringing you this kind of content, but only more of it. So that's just good news for you, frankly. But yeah. We'll get there together. But thank you for listening to Continued Success.
And there's
as always,
a point where you're
don't forget to subscribe, download, and rate our podcast on the Good Fight.
Say, stay
we,
with us.
We are, of course, got Hidden Season with John Stolness, Continued Success with myself and Liz Rocher, and The Dirty Inning, which we have a new episode with myself and Dr. Trevor Strunk. We talk about the worst, dumbest, most laughable, forgotten innings in Phillies history. And the last inning we did was from the first ever game in Phillies history, which actually included an argument between the umpire and the fans and the players and a gut-punching late-inning loss and all the stuff you'd come to expect from the Phillies. It's been happening since day one. So we appreciate your patronage and keep listening. As soon as Phillies news breaks, you will hear it probably on Hidden Season. On this podcast, we'll just like yell about it. But in any case, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time on Continued Success.
Hey, everybody, how you doing? Well, that's good. My name is Bill Matz. I am the director of Fun and Games for Broad Street Hockey Radio Podcasts.
And I am Kelly, the deputy managing editor of BroadStreetHockey.com.
I'm Steph Driver, the NHL editorial manager for SB Nation.
And I am Charlie O'Connor, lead Flyers writer for TheAthletic.com.
And together we make up BSH Radio, one of the shows that you get at the SB Nation podcast family. We have a lot coming to you this year, and we want you to listen to our show. It is just an all Flyers, all the time show, so much content. I really hope you listen to it. It is a great piece of the SB Nation podcast family, along with all your other favorite sports.
We all love hockey, specifically the Flyers.
Let's go the Flyers.
The hockey team, the Flyers.